The index cards are up here. If anybody wants to, even a comment or two would be great to put into the box here. Okay. Susan, it looks like there are some comments in the suggestion box, so here you go.
One of the things I forgot to share with you, and Christine over here mentioned the project that happened that Christina Taylor Green was part of called Faces of Hope. And this was a photographer who, after 9/11, did a small book on babies that were born on 9/11, and there was one from each state. And Christina Taylor Green represented Maryland. There she, well, it's hard to see, but I'm going to put these out so you can take a look at them afterwards. Her family was living there at the time. And there's a picture and the time of her birth and a little hope. It says, "I hope you help those in need. I hope you see rainbow." And then, ironically, 10 years later, the same photographer did a book on these babies 10 years later. And at that point, Christina had just recently been murdered, and the dedication is to her. But they do have her picture and a beautiful butterfly that she drew, which has now become the emblem or icon for the Christina Taylor Green Memorial Fund. There was so much money raised on her behalf and on behalf of the children of Tucson that they've started a foundation in her name, and they're doing some remarkable things. They've given large grants to the Children's Hospice, to Netito, and they also, and this is so moving to me, they provide a scholarship every year to a conference in Washington, D.C., which invites young women between the ages of 14 and 18 to Washington to meet congresswomen, to learn about women in politics. And the first year that scholarship was given in her name, the girl that won was also shot that day. She and her mother were also waiting behind Christina and her neighbor to greet Gabby. And so these connections are just incredible. So I'm going to leave these up front if you're interested. These are one very inspirational. And again, a response to suffering. What happens? What do we see in the midst of it? How do we look it straight in the face? And this is one woman's response. Her skill, her gift is photography. And she put these together, and they're quite remarkable. There are a couple of questions. Before the break, there weren't any, and I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but I'm going to assume it's good, and I will get to those. But I would like to finish with just a few remarks about that third question I posed at the beginning. How are we to be part of the healing of suffering? When we look suffering straight in the face, and we're open to life's pain and beauty, as John Philip Newell so beautifully describes, when we acknowledge the brokenness within us, and I so appreciated a number of you shared some of your experiences and stories with racism at the break, and we all have them, don't we? And if not racism, some other wound that is in need of healing. And I was glad they were healing stories. How do we become part of that? When I was working as a chaplain, often you get, your pager goes off and they don't tell you what it is. They just say, get to the emergency room. We have a trauma coming in. And I did one of two things when that happened. Because you don't know who it is or what it is. And I would often say, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ under my feet. And just repeat that. But the other thing that was very helpful for me and continues to be in my life is a prayer that I learned from Rachel Naomi Remen. Some of you may be familiar with her work. She's a pediatric oncologist and a psychologist. She's written a lot about illness, spirituality, and healing. And her two books that some of you may be familiar with, which are somewhat dated, but the stories are incredible, are My Grandfather's Blessings, which really is a story about what we do when we bless one another, a series of stories. And the other is kitchen table wisdom, what we get when we sit together and share. Well, in my grandfather's blessing, she shares this prayer that has become very important to me. It is, I do not understand the suffering. I do not understand the healing. But I am here. Use me. Such a simple prayer. We don't have to understand it. We don't have to explain it. But often we are there. We are put in situations where we can be useful. Well, you have someone in your midst that certainly rallied to that call. And Judith mentioned Maureen Earls, and many of you know. Maureen, where are you? Oh, come on. She's dressed for martyrdom. As Judith mentioned, Maureen has been involved in Fakose in Haiti. And when I heard about this originally, I went to Maureen and I said, sounds like a pilgrimage to me. And we had a wonderful conversation about the journey of getting there and going there. But when this topic and the discussion in the book came up, I really felt her story, I needed to unpack it more. And so I'm grateful that she would speak with me about it. Because for me, it's a story not only of pilgrimage, but how do we help in the healing process in the midst of suffering? And it's different for all of us. Maureen's journey, my journey, your journeys, we're all different. But we're all here to be used. And in my faith journey, that's part of the invitation of my faith. So it started for Maureen, and it never just happens. It starts somewhere. And for Maureen, although I know she's been a radical all her life, and I love that about her, it started when she participated in a 30-week program on peace and justice. This group out of the old mission met for 2 hours a week for 30 weeks. Now that's a pretty big commitment in and of itself. The program was called the Just Faith Program, and it's I haven't seen the material, but from Maureen's telling, it sounds like a wonderful resource having to do with prayer, reflection, scripture, study. It's work. It's really work. It takes you deeply into the process. But one of the most interesting things she shared with me, and I think is critical to our conversation today, is a concept she learned called border crossings. Now, we might find different words for that, but basically a border crossing is an opportunity to cross over, to meet the other. Homeless person, someone who's ill, orphanages, whatever. We make a border crossing. And the border crossing means we're not just reading about it anymore. We're having a face-to-face, one-on-one conversation with the other, whatever that other may be. And I think that's very powerful. One evening there was a role play. And again, that is kind of a border crossing if you get into it. And she played the role of a woman who was needing to get a microloan. And the whole role play simulated this Fankose banking process. They also had a speaker from Fankose who spoke about the project. And I like what Maureen shared with me. She said, that was it. That was it. I knew I had to go to Haiti. It's kind of like me saying, that's it. I got to go to Dubuque. So that started a process, but I would contend that she didn't get there that one evening. All the work, all the reading, all the reflection, everything in her life brought her to that point where she could say, yes, I'm going to go. And like most of us, she doesn't know what that's going to mean. It wasn't a luxury journey. She didn't stay in a fancy hotel. And actually, the work that now Maureen and others in this community are engaged in is in a community outside Port-au-Prince. And to get there We think going to Iona is tough. This trumps Iona. Dirt roads, crossing rivers, having to have armed guards at times. And she began her work in 2007 before the earthquake, and things have changed. Since that first visit, which she made in 2007, Maureen and other members of this community have raised over $100,000 to support the bank in Focosé and the literacy program. These funds are used in a number of different ways. I'm not a spokesperson. Maureen should give you a lot more specific information, but literacy is key. We know that for women, that when they can read and write and do numbers and communicate, they are able to sustain a business. They learn about financing. Their children are educated. They work on health issues and a connection to the environment. So issues of sustainability and how to work with the environment. When you talk with Maureen about this project and the people she visits every year, she doesn't talk about the suffering. She's aware of it. It's part of the package. But she talks about the joy and what she has learned. And she's crossed a lot of borders to get to this place. And she has amazing stories. And she says it's the stories and the voices of these women that ring in her head all year long. And they impact and affect everything she does. When she looks at a conflict or a trouble or a difficulty, she hears those voices. So much of what we go through is so different here. Whether it's health care, tragedies, whatever, the resources we have are so different. So that voice, that border crossing, has become cellular memory. Part of her spirit and her soul. Maureen was paid the biggest compliment by Judith that I think we can all hope to achieve, and she said, you know, Maureen walks the talk. She walks the talk. It's the real deal. So in the spirit of that, as Judith mentioned, I invite you all on behalf of Maureen to the March 17th St. Patrick's Day Fiesta Festival, Kaylee. It's a multifaceted family event that not only celebrates a heritage richly, but also there's wonderful food, music, and you help support an incredible project. And I understand there's going to be a video, and it's an incredible evening. Biff and I are really hoping we'll be able to attend. I wanted to talk. There's so many things I'd love to share and get your feedback about, but if you would just put those up quickly. This Focosé project is doing some incredible things, and that's the macro and the micro we can talk about. But one of the things that has, when I look at communities that are healing, is how do they ritualize and memorialize their suffering, their difficulty. And I've been researching and putting myself in those places. And actually, a couple of years ago, I attended a conference on blessing in Washington, D.C., and it just happened. We decided, well, we're so close, we'll go down to Washington. I wanted to see the Pentagon Memorial in particular for 9/11. And we went and didn't think it through, but we were actually there on Veterans Day, which was very powerful. We ended up visiting many of the memorials in Washington, D.C., but the first one I really wanted to see was the Pentagon. It is an incredible sight. You walk around to the back side of the Pentagon, and as the closer you get, the quieter it gets. Sacred sites are often that way. Thin places kind of have their own energy that stills us. And one of the first things you see is this sign that just is kind of stark, but says the memorial. And I had known that there were 184 benches, a bench for each of the victims. But as I read more and actually got to the site, it was quite overwhelming. This is at night, and you see there is a metal bench, and it has a small pool of water underneath that is illuminated. The funds from this came from private individuals. Each bench has the name of the victim, and they start with the youngest, who is 1 year old, and they go all the way to the oldest, who is 71. And the line of the benches, and this is the intentionality of memorials that can really, I think, help with healing, it moves into the building at the angle the plane went in. And each of the benches, in addition to the name, if the victim was in the Pentagon, the bench faces out from the Pentagon. If the victim was in the plane, the bench is, the name is heading toward the Pentagon. So as you move around the site, it's quite, quite powerful. This is one of the benches. And this water element, it was incredible. And volunteers, and we saw a number of them, come and clean out the pools. And the trees haven't quite grown up there, but it's very, very beautiful. I think I've got one more. No, we'll let that go. I was very, very moved. But I'd also heard something else about that memorial. It's two parts. It's the outdoor part. And then inside, for the first time in the history of the Pentagon, with the funds they raised, they built a memorial chapel. The Pentagon had never had a sacred space for worship. So when chaplains or groups wanted to meet, they had to reserve a room. But there was a lot of intentionality on the part of the employees and the Washington community, and the funds were raised to have a 70-seat sacred space, a memorial chapel, in the Pentagon. And that chapel is right at the intersection where the plane went in. It's incredible. I've only seen pictures. The chaplains, there's a beautiful kind of stained glass piece that has 84 pieces of crimson stone. And at a chaplain conference for the military, each of the chaplains had one of the stones and the names, and they mounted those and placed them in the memorial. They've had weddings there. They've had memorial services there. They have, I think now, there are up to 10 worship services, interfaith worship services a week. And in addition to that, there are 56 faith-related activities in the Pentagon a week. That didn't happen before. So again, in the midst of such a tragic thing, to find such hope and beauty. Well, I want to conclude by just saying I think this chapter invites us to some basic practices or ways of being in the world. I think John Philip Newell in the material does. The first is listening. Listening. Maureen spent 30 weeks and probably half her life listening before that project presented itself. She could have said no. She could have moved on. But I believe that listening is very critical to how we can be instruments of healing. I think there's preparation, and that preparation involves waiting. We don't just get there. We have to wait. We have to contemplate. We have to wait, holy waiting. It's very difficult. It was a long time between my trip to Alabama and my experience in Allen Temple. It's a long wait, and it's not finished. So waiting, I think, is important. I think prayer is critical. And we've been experiencing and practicing forms, different forms of prayer, simple prayer, like John Philip Newell, just feeling your heart beat is so important. But Annie Lamont has a new book out. I don't know if you've heard about it. It's a great title. She wrote Traveling Mercies and Bird by Bird. She's a fairly cryptic writer on the spiritual path, but wonderful. Her new book, get this, is titled Help, Thanks, and Wow. Three essential prayers. The first prayer, help, is I'm doomed. I can't handle it. It's too much. There'll never be any resolution. The second prayer, thanks, is gratitude, wonder, Oh my gosh, it's those little ahas when we have the experience of revelation and lift it up. And the third one, wow, is the realization that we're all in the same boat. No bishop, no priest, no king, no president is any more ahead or more behind than any of us. Wow. She says it's all about trust, surrender, and showing up. I love what she says about surrender. Prayer can be motion and stillness and energy all at the same time. It begins with stopping in our tracks or with our backs against the wall or when we are going under the waves or when we are so sick and tired of being psychically sick and tired that we surrender. Or at least we finally stop running away and at long last walk or lurch or crawl towards something. Or maybe miraculously, we just release our grip slightly. That works for me. I think the last of those listening, prayer, waiting, the last one for me, and this is very important in my life, is blessing. And I think John O'Donohue, who I know many of you are familiar with and who we lost way too soon, in his wonderful book, To Bless the Space Between Us, says this about blessing. It's so simple. What is blessing? A blessing is a circle of light drawn around a person to protect, heal, and strengthen. Life is a constant flow of emergence. The beauty of blessing is its belief that it can affect what unfolds. We bless because we believe it will affect what unfolds. And whether it's a Celtic blessing from the Carmina Gadelica, a blessing that we say to our loved one before they leave, I love that definition. Excuse me. Well, I'd like to have a few moments for the questions and just end my part with a wonderful blessing that John O'Donohue wrote for suffering. And I thought it would kind of pull together what we've talked about. May you be blessed in the holy names of those who, without knowing it, help to carry and lighten your pain. May you know serenity when you are called to enter the house of suffering. May a window of light always surprise you. May you be granted the wisdom to avoid false resistance. When suffering knocks at the door of your life, may you glimpse its eventual gifts. May you be able to receive the fruits of suffering. May memory bless and protect you with the hard-earned light of past travail to remind you that you have suffered before, and though the darkness now is deep, you will soon see the approaching light. May the grace of time heal your wounds. May you know that though the storm might rage, not a hair of your head will be harmed. Amen. This is wonderful, a sharing. It says, perhaps this really is a good day for the topic, given the quote, whose source I do not yet know, but I'll share it with you. Grief is the tax that we pay for loving. Grief is the tax we pay for loving. I really like that. Please talk about the falling house of cards, I think, is the question in the Catholic community, suffering in the midst of beauty. I had a series of photos that another story that I didn't have time to offer you, but I do want to offer this story. I think it connects with the question how I understand it. We have to look, whether it's Catholic or Episcopalian or Buddhist or what, we are all flawed and wounded, and how do we move forward? And one of the things that really touched me was, some of you are familiar with the Solidarity Project. There are a group of people in the community seeking a response, particularly to the abuse at St. Anthony's. And one day I was up at the Center for Renewal, and as I drove up the back way, I noticed a huge stone that's there. It obviously had to be placed with a crane or something. I mean, it's huge. And maybe you could bring that slide up, Biff. I was meeting with Sister Susan, and I said, What is that about? What's that doing out there? And she said, oh, it's part of the Solidarity Project. Have any of you seen it or been to it? Yeah. There it is. This is a huge stone with a plaque in the center. And she said there are a group of people who've been working on this project, and it's a stone to recognize the woundedness in this community around the House of Cards. And I said, is it okay to go down there? And she said, of course. And of course, for me, as I approach what I consider a sacred site, there's a silence that comes. And I did move closer. You want to? I think we can read it. Can you see it? Can you read the words? It's very poignant. It acknowledges the abuse and the pain that was suffered, and the pain of the families, the schoolmates, the friars, and the community. This bench and stone are a symbol of our commitment to the healing process and our will to reconcile our past with hope for the future. We embrace and honor all those memories. I think that's very profound, very well worded. Now, what even moved me more is on that stone, you want to do the next one, is there are a number of cairns. And I didn't even get into cairns today, but as a pilgrim, you depend. You'll see one right up here. I've got one in my hand. You depend on cairns. They're the waymarkers. That's how you find the way. And it's a metaphor for me of those things that lead us on our path. And I was so surprised to see a number of cairns placed on this stone. And then in a basket, this with stones, was this inscription. It says, stones. Take one, hold one, bring one, leave one. Touch, bless, keep, give. I took one. And I keep it on my desk by my computer. And I've taken some back. It's a place I go. It's helpful for me. Not about this particular wound, but about many wounds. And that we all have waymarkers. We all have stones that can guide our way. And I think this is a little step. It's a little step. But I think that's how change happens. And for me, that's a possibility. A possibility. Right in our own community. And if you haven't been there, I would take a walk. And the other thing that's there, right next to it, is one of those long green benches. And those apparently were the athletic benches that the kids would sit on before sports events. Some of you may have done that. And that one is dedicated to a priest who, as part of the community, was very helpful in healing. So you've got all of it right there. The pain, the acknowledgement of the suffering, and take one, be one, heal one, and hope. And it's for me, it's a very, very powerful place. This is a question. How did you not discuss the issues of Black being separate and second class? Was there a dialogue, a passion? I've had that dialogue with other members, not only of the Black community, but many other communities. Because of my study of Bhakti Yoga Kundalini, I've been very involved with the Sikh community. And they have experienced incredible prejudice in this country. And you know about the shootings in Wisconsin. As a matter of fact, one of the police officers that was first on scene there was recognized at the State of the Union the other night. So I think it's an ongoing conversation that we all have. I don't have it all figured out. I don't know what the answers are. But I do know, and that's where that language of border crossing really helps me, is that I have to put myself in the places where that conversation can happen. It means going to interfaith services. It meant when the shootings happened, I said to my husband, I have to worship with the Sikh community. And the Sikhs I know are mostly in India, but I needed that. And we drove down to Orange County and went to a Guru's, Nak Singh's Gurdwara there. Sikh community is really incredible. And in Orange County, because there were shootings, there were several deaths after 9/11 because of they do wear the turban. They were mistaken, and there's been a lot of prejudice. But we sat in a worship service where there was also the chief of police. There were so many members of the interfaith community who were having that conversation. And being there, when we walked in, these young Sikhs, young people, 14, 15 years old, like my experience at Allen Temple, they welcomed us and said, you must come, you must eat. You must, before you go to worship, you have to eat. And when we went up to the sanctuary area, I just sat down on the floor. Biff went over and sat against the wall. And after a while, some precious young girl came up to me and she said, you need to sit over there. This side's for the men. And most of the Sikh things I'd been involved with, they didn't separate men and women. But, you know, come with us. Come over here and sit with us, which was very precious. But did I sit down and have a long conversation about the issues? I have. But I, for me, and I can't say for it, it's being in that experience. It's worshiping with people who are suffering and learning their culture and learning their values and saying, I care. I do not understand the suffering. I do not understand the healing. But I'm here. What can I do? What can I do? Any other questions, comments, I think? God bless you all. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Susan. Isn't she wonderful? Next week's speaker, Pat McClure, she's here. She's going to be on Chapter 5, Digging Out God. Mm-hmm. That's next week. So thank you and goodbye till next week.